First time that we've hosted a long-term investor forum. I'm sure many of our external guests and I'm sure the internal people joining the call know very well our monthly investor forum, which is used to inform our tactical 6 to 12 month view. And the idea here is that we can do this longer-term forum to inform our capital market assumptions, our long-term views on portfolios, our longer-term outlook, and thinking in a 3 to 5 or even longer-term time horizon. We are going to make a start with the debate on debt levels and interest rates. Here we're going to have Karen Ward, who's the Chief Market Strategist for EMEA for JP Morgan Asset Management. She's going to be discussing the view that, you know, perhaps positive interest rates, or at least meaningfully positive interest rates, are perhaps a thing of the past, and that the way out of the current debt crisis is going to be for central banks to, you know, continue with their loose monetary policies. And then on the other side of the debate, we're going to have Jim Leavis, who's the CIO of Public Fixed Income, who's very kindly agreed to represent the alternative the viewpoint here, whereby perhaps high debt levels lead to investors demanding a higher risk premium on that debt. So we'll start with Karen, and we're going to get each speaker to give just 3 minutes their overview on what their view is, and then we'll open it up for questions. So Karen, why don't we start with you? Are positive interest rates a thing of the past?
Okay, 3 minutes. so I think we're going to come out of this with developed world government debt substantially higher than we came into it. This is the recession that was no one's fault, and therefore socializing the problem, bringing that onto the government's balance sheet, is going to have serious debt repercussions. I would say at least 20% higher, and I think it will be permanent. So the US debt level, for example, about 135% of GDP, Italy 160%. All of this debt, as we're already seeing, I think will be transferred to the central bank and held there permanently. I think the idea of even attempting quantitative tightening again won't even be entertained. I think the central banks will have shifted to yield curve control, basically because the fiscal requirement is so uncertain. That's the only way they can really backstop the government bond markets, by just saying, we're not quantity targeting, we're price targeting. So we will have moved to yield curve control. So that's the very near term. As we come out of this, the question then is, does that higher debt promote a new wave of austerity? I think the answer to that is no chance. There's no appetite in the electorate to conceive of an austerity again. And therefore, that debt is not going to be dealt with via trying to pay it back. So you're probably thinking at this point, I'm arguing for the higher rates, because actually I think nominal GDP will recover as basically the monetary and the fiscal stimulus stays in the pipeline. But I'm not arguing that. I think the central banks will maintain zero policy rates. They will maintain their yield curve control, and they will be successful in that. I think the 1940s is an example of how yield curve control, a determined central bank, can hold down yields despite nominal GDP recovering quite well. I think it's no coincidence that just 3 weeks ago, the New York Fed published a paper called How the Fed Managed the Treasury Yield Curve in the 1940s. And I'm quite surprised they disclosed it rather than just working on it internally. It does mean they endogenized the size of their balance sheet as they move to that price rather than quantity target. But that's where I think they're going. Now, is this all very suspect? Is it on order of the president? No, I think they'll argue this is all entirely consistent with their mandate. Before the crisis, they were already moving to average inflation targeting, and the idea that because of past misses of inflation, having undershot the target, they should accommodate a period of excess expansion and inflation above target. And I think they will use that average inflation targeting framework to have an overshoot for a number of years and not adjust policy accordingly and stay with that very low interest rate and yield curve control policies in place.
Karen, thank you. I'm going to stop you there. Very clear, very convincing. Jim, continued spending, yield curve control, Sounds good. What's your view?
What we've got to remember is that the amount of debt that the developed world is going to end up with as we come out of this year is just going to be unprecedented. So in 1990, amongst the G7, debt to GDP ratio, if you include household debt, government debt and corporate debt, was something like 200% of G7 GDP. By the end of this year, it's going to be over 300% and trending higher. It was already trending higher thanks to demographic reasons, healthcare spending, even before this crisis, but it's just going to exponentially explode. So how do we deal with that? And there are only really three ways we can deal with a debt burden of that kind of scale. The first way is to grow our way out of the problem. And, you know, there was that famous Olivier Blanchard, the ex-IMF economist paper that came out in January last year that said, don't worry, guys, you can carry on issuing as much debt as you like as long as your growth rate is greater than the amount of interest you're paying on that debt. And that's not going to be true anymore. You know, that was true up to coronavirus. Now the hole in GDP that's going to be blown, it's not going to be permanent. Of course, there will be a strong rebound. But, you know, depending on whether you think of this as some sort of natural disaster, the equivalent of a hurricane or a tsunami, which is relatively short-lived and then things get back to normal, or in fact, maybe a slightly stronger thanks to the fiscal impulse, you know, maybe there is a chance we get back to a normal growth pattern. But certainly for the foreseeable future, this may be years, a couple of years of low growth. And so debt ratios will carry on growing. And for economies like Italy, even Olivia Blanchard's optimistic interest rates are below the rate of growth wasn't true anyway. So we were left in a world of exploding debt in certain areas of developed markets. So it does need to be dealt with, and growth may be one of the outcomes, but at these levels of debt to GDP, it becomes a lot less helpful. The second way is inflation, and Karen talked about effectively monetizing the debt. And, you know, that I agree that that is a strong possibility. Those bonds will never, ever see the light of day again. And that helps because let's think about the UK, for instance. Let's say we have a debt to GDP ratio of 100%, but the Bank of England owns half the gilt, half the public debt. You can either cancel them and just pretend they never existed, or better still, you just don't do anything with them and allow the central bank's balance sheet to kind of gradually stay there forever. And effectively, then your debt to GDP ratio comes down to 50%. My question is, though, whether it's naive to think that at some stage people don't start to wonder about places like Zimbabwe, Venezuela, and just kind of think about this as something that is a disaster for currencies, for inflation. And I think there's a lot of debates about who will have the upper hand when these 20% of US workers who are going to be unemployed by the end of next week, when they come back into the workforce, who's going to win that battle? Will it be capital? Will it be labor? And I think that capital has had the upper hand for two or three decades now. So the profit share of GDP has definitely gone to capitalists rather than labor. Perhaps, I think, as Karen alluded to, you know, when we come out of this, there'll be a change in that attitude. The healthcare workers, the frontline workers in shops, on buses, will suddenly not just realize that they do have more bargaining power because everyone will be trying to hire people back into the workforce at the same time, but also there'll be a moral imperative to do that. And finally, the other way of dealing with the debt burden is default. And I don't think if you're the UK or the US, you need to worry about default in any way. You can print your own currency. But there are other forms of default, and I would include in that, think about what Ireland did coming out of the Eurozone crisis in terms of going into people's pension funds and taking a haircut, taking money away from asset managers at source in order to finance the deficits that they had. And the other thing I think that worries me more as a bond investor than anything else is that default is not just about ability to repay your debts, but it's also about willingness to repay your debts. And I think, you know, if you look at what's happened around the world, Italy has told people you don't need to pay your mortgages for the foreseeable future. That's happened elsewhere as well. UK banks have written to people and said, you know, there's going to be forbearance. Everything's about, you know, you don't have to pay at the moment. And we see that even people who have the ability to repay their rents, thinking about shop owners, some big profile department stores, for instance, they could pay their rents, but they see an opportunity now to say, actually, I'm not going to pay a dividend. I'm going to pass on this bond coupon because it's marginally optional for me. And I think that as a bond investor, all of these three things together make me worry that this 30 to 40 year bull market in fixed income that we've seen really since Paul Volcker came into the Fed and decided to kill inflation, but helped by a demographic wave of longevity providing demand for fixed income, maybe that's tailing off a bit because of coronavirus. Thanks to technology, which I think remains in place, and thanks to globalization, which is the other thing that might be under threat, maybe all of these things together make you say that we're not going to have as easy ride as we did before. The very final quick thing I'd say is the dog that didn't bark for bond investors this time round was the ECB. The whole world has thrown everything at coronavirus. It's thrown quantitative easing, special loan programs. It's thrown fiscal spending of roughly 4 to 5% of GDP on the government's part. Every central bank around the world has also cut interest rates. The ECB didn't, because it knows it's at the lower bound. It knows it's not going to do any good. And that kind of changes the risk return profile for a government bond investor in Europe. You know now what your upside is. Your upside is kind of limited by the ECB, which isn't going any lower in terms of negative interest rates. And I think that's really important. The most important thing, the most important policy announcement we have had as a bond investor is the announcement that the ECB aren't doing anything with interest rates.
Jim, I'm going to stop you there. Thank you for that. And I'm going to give Karen, I guess, the chance to respond to any of those points. And I guess some specifically that I would ask is, you know, Jim's talked about the potential for, you know, growth as being a means out of this. Is the world that you describe one where we see trend long-term growth, or what we currently think about as trend long-term growth, or is that going to lead to a crowding out sort of effect where we see lower long-term growth? And then secondly, I guess, on what are the implications for a bond holder? Obviously, if the central banks are enacting curve control, but what does that mean for a private investor? Is it that your upside is limited, as Jim says, or are you still good to kind of hold these? So I'll put those to you, Karen, or anything else you'd like to respond to from what Jim has said.
Yeah, great. So let me break some of that down. In terms of the recovery, in real terms, I think it could remain to some degree sluggish. I mean, I think particularly companies are going to come out of this with higher levels of debt, and therefore the investment that we've been waiting for the last 10 years is still going to remain very lackluster, and that's going to keep us in a relatively sluggish growth world and a productivity world, as well as, I think, less global trade. I do think there's going to be longer term implications for globalization. I know you're talking about that later. So I think real growth might be a bit sluggish. I think there's going to be more inflation, though. I agree with a lot of what Jim said in terms of underlying drivers of inflation. One of the things I think we totally misunderestimated in the last 10 years is the role that austerity played in holding inflation down. I mean, quite simply, if 25% of your workforce is in the public sector on a pay freeze, it's very hard to get inflation going. And as I say, I don't think austerity is coming back. I think there's no appetite for it. So I think we'll see a higher level of nominal growth, but largely most of that through prices rather than real activity. So I think what's really interesting between Jim and I think actually the difference is in our view, and this is where it's going to get very fascinating, is whether despite a pickup in nominal growth, the central bank can still hold the interest rate down, and over what maturities. Hence, I'm really looking at the 1940s experience, the combination of financial repression, which we knew has been in place post GFC, that will probably intensify. You need both financial repression and you need a central bank willing to endogenize the debt level as it targets price. But as I say, I think this will be very much they've set the scene perfectly with their discussion about average inflation targeting and targeting the price level. We came into this recession with them saying the price level is below where we think it should be from 5 years of undershoot. We're now going to come out the other side with that deviation on the price level even more stark, and they will use that to justify keeping rates low, allowing inflation to pick up, because they will talk about it as compensating for the past. So I think that's the interesting part. I think that's where Jim and I really disagree, is about the power of the central bank and its ability to basically hold interest rates where the economy would suggest they shouldn't be. And in fact, you know, our bond traders, we had a fascinating conversation when we were talking about credit, about the role of fundamentals in a world where central banks are so active, you know, and one of our traders put it, I think, perfectly, which is, are technicals the new fundamentals? And I think there's a lot to that. If they want to hold these interest rates down, I think they're going to be able to. And therefore, I think, you know, coming into how that makes you feel about the bond market, certainly core bonds, you know, not particularly attractive. I'm not worried about the downside of the bond bubble bursting, as I've just described, because I think they are successful in holding yields low. But, you know, that's your upside is clearly capped as well. So it's a sort of total absence of volatility in either direction, as yield curve control, the name would dictate.
Thanks, Karen. And so I'm just going to put a final one to Jim, and we're going to get on to inflation in the next session. So, you know, how can bond yields move higher if central banks are controlling the level of yields in your scenario, Jim? And I guess, you know, in your sort of capacity as a CIO for fixed income, you're obviously looking at things which can rally in the event of wider declines in other equity markets. What other assets are there out there that you think could be better portfolio hedges in a future world?
Well, I think if you think about the assets that are out there that could protect you from, you know, remember, I'm not arguing what I believe in right now, because I'm actually in Karen's camp when it comes to the fact that bond yields will probably stay very low for a long time, and in part thanks to that yield curve control, thanks to the end of central bank independence to some extent, and thanks to the idea that it will be very damaging for interest rates to go up, and we can't afford to do that. In some ways, this feels like the end of capitalism as we've known it and enjoyed it for a long period of time. So I think that we can say it's unlikely that we see a dramatic backup in yields. What we could see, though, is a significant increase in inflation. And for that reason, how can you protect your portfolio? And I think it's really important to note that the expected inflation baked into Treasury inflation protected securities, for instance, at the moment, is hardly anything at all. And that's partly a knee-jerk reaction to the fun and games that's been going on in oil contracts over the past week or month. You know, we all know that economic growth is going to be weak for the foreseeable future. It's justified that oil prices are very, very low. Storage stuff means that they should go negative, and that's going to feed through into inflation. And in the US, it will feed through much more quickly than everyone else, because they don't tax gasoline like we do in Europe or the UK. And so therefore, we will see a big disinflationary slowdown in the US, combined with the lack of demand for goods and services. It's also going to feed through into collapsing inflation. But remember, we'd need to see the oil price fall the year after, the year after, the year after, the year after, and the year after that by the same amount every year, just to maintain the same level of inflation. And that's really unlikely. At some point, we will come out of this. We will see the strongest quarter of economic growth that the world has ever seen. That's simply mathematical. So we're going to see incredibly strong growth. We are going to see energy prices come back again and all of that. And so if you can take advantage of both having a view that interest rates are going to stay low for a long time, and that's going to benefit bond prices, but also that there might be strong levels of inflation, and you don't want to see your, you know, you don't mind being a bond holder because you know that yields are being held down by central banks, but you also know that if you're kind of a forced bond holder, and that's part of the financial repression that Karen talked about, you know, forcing banks to own government bonds in their capital, forcing pension funds to earn a certain amount of fixed income, etc. If you own Treasury inflation protected securities, you're pricing in inflation of just 0.5% per year over the next 5 years. And for the next year, fine, that's bang on. That's probably, you know, you probably expect to see inflation below that for the next year. But over 5 years, is that likely, given the world that both Karen and I have talked about, where Labour perhaps does get the upper hand? I think that the, you know, as a tail hedge for either eventuality, really, Treasury inflation protected securities are one way of saying, I don't quite know what's going to happen, but bond yields are going to be held down. And remember, the Fed also buys TIPS as part of its QE program. But it's the cheapest insurance policy you can get right now.
Jim, thank you. And I know you're going to stay in the debating chair, so to speak, for the next part. And we've very nicely moved on to inflation. And thank you, Karen, for your comments on debt and interest rates.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the global wealth management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.